Hi, everyone. Welcome to Nancy's Metaphysical World and More. My name is Nancy, and I host the show. And today, my guest is a really great guest. This is one topic, and anybody that listens to the show knows I am totally, totally into. So we're going to bring her on real quick. We're not going to wait. We're going to get as much information out as we can. She is the author of UFOs, Generals, Pilots, and Government Officials Go on the Record. And her name is Leslie Kane. So, Leslie, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Nancy. It's great to be here.
Now, before we talk about your book, Leslie, let's talk a little bit about Leslie and who Leslie is and what got you going into the UFO hunt.
Okay, well, I'm an investigative journalist by training, and I worked for a number of years at a public radio station in California called KPFA. It's a Pacifica network, and I was a producer and host on a daily investigative news program. And prior to that, I'd done a lot of writing and publishing of freelance articles in various newspapers in America and in other countries as well on different topics. So I had a pretty good, a pretty well-established career as an investigative reporter and writer when I got this report from France, which was about the UFO subject as it pertained to national security concerns. And a friend of mine from France sent this to me, a colleague, and it was this incredible 90-page report written by a group of generals, at least four generals and an admiral, and the former head of the National Space Studies Center in France, which is the equivalent of our NASA here. And a group of scientists and others had formed together and studied data on the UFO subject for 3 years, and they studied official cases and interviewed many pilots who had been involved with sightings of UFOs, the very best evidence they could find, and then published this 90-page study. And in it, they laid out a bunch of very interesting cases. And the whole thing was really interesting. But what really piqued my interest as a journalist was not only information about the cases that they provided, but their conclusion, which was just astonishing to me. And that was that they stated that, as far as they were concerned, after having done this study, the best explanation for the cases that they presented was what they called the extraterrestrial hypothesis. And they stated that, of course, this couldn't, we can't prove it. We can't prove that these things are extraterrestrial, but they stated that they thought that was there was a high probability that these cases represented something of that nature. And I thought for a bunch of high-level military people to come out with a statement like that, that it was very likely that we were being visited by extraterrestrial craft, I thought that was a really big story. And that's what got me started on this whole business back about 11 years ago.
That's kind of neat. I'm always into UFO stuff. So when I interview a lot of people, I interview people who talk about the first spaceships that they think have been here, thousands and thousands of years ago, as compared to what's here now, and why there's so much cover-up going on. And I have a really hard time with all the cover-ups, Leslie, because it's like, you've been lying about it for so long, you've been trying to cover it up for so long, and everybody who has any, thought at all have to believe that we are not the only intelligent beings in this entire, whatever you want to call it, because it's not just the world, not just the universe, it goes on beyond that, But there are people who really do believe that we are the only intelligent things. And my thought with that is, if we are the only intelligent things, we're in serious trouble.
I agree with you on that one. Yeah. And I think, it's really true that more and more scientists now really are willing to acknowledge, and with the search for extraterrestrial or extrasolar planets that's going on, and they're discovering more and more Earth-like planets almost every day now. And I really think that, the scientific community, most of them will pretty much acknowledge that they don't believe we're the only, living beings in the universe, that there probably is life out there. I think those attitudes have really changed, and there's a lot of excitement about, searching for that out, in these other, with these, the Kepler and all the other devices that we have out there looking for life. But there's not really a connection between that and the UFO phenomenon in most of these people's minds, and that's where we have a big gap. They don't consider the evidence for UFOs to be valid, but they're still out there looking for signs of extraterrestrial life out there. So hopefully we can bridge that gap sometime, and maybe some of them will take an interest in looking at this information. And really what I've tried to do by writing this book is just provide the kind of information, as I stated earlier, this is information that was taken seriously by generals. So I'm trying to provide the kind of data and factual information and the absolute most convincing facts that we have to that really prove, in my opinion, and I think anybody who reads the book will agree with me, prove the existence of some kind of physical phenomenon. The question is, what is it? And just like the French general stated in their report back in 1999, I don't think we yet know what they actually are, or at least that's the way the scientific community views this. So, but we absolutely know for certain that there is something there, and it's physical. And it has left traces on the ground, it has left marks on radar, it is, you know, we photographed it, there's all kinds of physical data to prove this. But the mystery is, what is it? And that still has to be discovered. And my book really doesn't go beyond, draw conclusions about what they actually are. But like these generals and like many of the others who have investigated this, I certainly agree that there's a likelihood that they're extraterrestrial, and many of the people in my book state that. So I just want people to know also that the book is not written entirely by me, but I actually invited many of these high-level officials to contribute chapters to the book. So you can read directly. I've got generals and Air Force pilots and commercial pilots and, you know, a colonel from the American Air Force, some very interesting high-level and very credible people who have written their own chapters for the book, people who have headed up agencies in other countries that have spent decades investigating UFOs for governments in other countries. So it's the most credible people, and I think it's exciting for readers to read directly from them and read stories of their own encounters that they write about without me having to provide the information. They do it themselves.
Which is kind of good because, I mean, I know that there are a lot of people out there, Leslie, who have probably had many different kinds of encounters. And to hear, you know, from a general and pilots and then other government officials, you know, that's pretty good because a lot of people really won't want to believe something until there is that kind of high-level people who say, yeah, this is a fact because this is what I saw. You know,
right.
And I think that's real important. Leslie, if somebody wants to get your book, how do they go about getting it?
Well, I mean, it's available on Amazon, and I do have a website which I can give out right now. It's UFOsOnTheRecord.com. And if you go to my website, again, UFOsOnTheRecord.com, I have links right on the homepage to where you can get the book. Or if you'd rather just go directly to Amazon, few months ago, the book came out in paperback. So there is a hardback edition and a paperback edition, but the paperback edition is really cheap on Amazon because they always have good prices for things. So that's where I would recommend getting it. Bookstores have it as well, but you're going to get a better price for it if you order it online.
Which is kind of neat. See, I live in New Mexico. New Mexico has this wonderful history of all UFO things that's gone on here. You know, they have Roswell.
Right.
They have Dulce, the town of Dulce, that is kind of a weird, strange town. And they have all different kinds of sightings. And exactly where I live is by the mountains called the Manzano Mountains. And my house is the last house to the mountains. So we get to see a lot of incredible things out here. And about 2 weeks ago, you know, I was in my office and my mom comes in and says to me, "Hey, Nancy, there's some strange lights out here now." You know, and Kirkland Air Force Base is northeast of us. So things don't surprise me too much because of all the things that Kirkland does. But she said, "No, these lights are really kind of funny, Nancy. You need to come and look at them." So I got up, and by the time I went to the kitchen, they were gone. She said, "I think they were going toward Tracy's house, which is my daughter." So I go and I look out our dining room window. And sure enough, Leslie, there's this huge white circular set of lights that are just blinking as they go around, you know.
Wow.
And it didn't make one sound. It was hovering, you know, just kind of floating. It looked like it was just floating, kind of really neat. And then it just kind of went and then disappeared. And I went, that's kind of cool. You know, that's kind of interesting. Now, you know, we don't know if it's Kirkland testing some of their things that they do or if it was a true UFO, you know, but I'm always into it. And you know, so anytime I get to see strange lights out here in the sky, I always kind of go, "Oh, man, what is that? If you're there, come on down here and see me."
I don't blame you. I mean, it'd be fascinating. I've never seen anything like that. So,
you could
try calling Kirkland, you know, if you see something like that and see if they would ever tell you whether they were testing something. I don't know if they would. I don't know if people do that out there, if they make phone calls and try to find out.
Well, usually what I've been told is when people make phone calls out here, they hear it's a hot weather, a hot air balloon or a weather balloon or something like that. I mean, because one night we sat here and we saw this triangular-shaped thing up in the sky, and according to the news that came out, it was a weather balloon. Now, I have a hard
triangular?
Time believing.
Yeah.
I have a hard time believing some of the media coverage of what people see out here, you know. And we're up very, very late at night, so we get to see a lot of strange things. And I'll tell you one other story about out here. When we'd been here for about probably, we've only been here less than 3 years, but about a year and a half after we were here, so about a year ago, I was like, we go to bed very late. So I was like, my bedroom faces due east to the mountains, and I always look out the window, you know, because I'm upstairs, and I can see like for miles. And I look out the window above the mountain, and there's this huge white glowing ball. I mean, just huge, not moving. I watched it for probably 15, 20 minutes. This thing didn't move. And then all of a sudden, it shot off red lasers and then just disappeared. And
I thought, did you take a picture?
I didn't, because my phone camera that I have wouldn't photograph it very well. And I didn't have a camera handy, but I'm thinking, oh, man, I got to get a telescope, you know.
That would be great, or if you got a camera with a telephoto lens. It seems like you have a lot of sightings out there.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot out here. But, you know, so you actually been studying for a long time with UFOs. Now, in your book, and you talked to a lot of people, and they wrote their stories, which person that you actually have in your book, Leslie, did you find the most interesting, their story?
Oh, boy, I don't think I really couldn't single one out above the others, Nancy. It's pretty hard to do that. You know, there are a lot of different types of stories in here. I mean, one of the more exciting ones, if you want something really dramatic, is Parviz Jafari, who's now a general in Iran, who wrote a story about his famous incident in 1976 over Tehran, in which he actually attempted to shoot down some projectiles that were being sent to him from this gigantic UFO. It's an amazing story. It's very dramatic and scary, and you feel like you're reading science fiction, but we know it's not science fiction, partly because there was a U.S. government document that detailed exactly what happened in this case. There was an American official that was over there and went to the debriefing afterwards. So it's very well documented, many, many witnesses to it as well. I can tell you the story, if you'd like, you know, about what happened, just briefly. He was, at the time, it was in 1976, he was, first, one plane was sent up with two flyers, one pilot and what they call a backseater, a second person in the plane, went up to try to check out this brilliant kind of star-like object that was just kind of suspended over, the way you talked about the ball hanging there and not moving. It was sort of like that, only it was very high, it was up over Tehran, and it looked kind of like a gigantic star that wasn't a star. And lots of citizens were calling up and reporting it to the Air Force Tower at the airport, and there were the military was alerted, and the generals, people on the ground were seeing it, and they sent up first one plane, and when the plane would get too close to it, it would lose power. It would lose control of its communications equipment. I mean, it didn't lose power so that it would crash or anything, but it lost the ability to communicate with the ground. And it came back, and the second craft that went up was piloted by General Jafari, who's the one who wrote the chapter in the book. And he got really quite close to it. Again, when he got too close, he would lose his equipment if he got about 25 miles away. But he described it as this absolutely brilliant kind of pulsating triangular light. He said it looked like a strobe light, and it was flashing all these different colors, kind of spinning. And it was so bright that he said you couldn't see any physical body. The way he described it was you couldn't see the body of anything. It was just this brilliant, brilliant flashing light, like a big, gigantic strobe. And he was up there just trying to get a better look at it, and suddenly these smaller spherical objects started coming out of the larger one and heading right for his plane. And this happened three times, I believe, maybe two times. And he thought he had to try to shoot at them because they were heading right for him, and he was afraid, you know, that they were going to hit him and he was going to have a collision. So he got his equipment all set, and he had a heat-seeking missile which he could lock on with. He lock on to the object, which means that the missile's all set to fire on it. And just at the moment when he was about to press the trigger to fire at this projectile, he lost control of his equipment. And then the thing, unfortunately, didn't hit him. Then another one came. He did the same thing. He got his heat-seeking missile locked onto the object, was just about to press the button to fire it, and again, he lost equipment at the very last minute. And a third time, the same thing happened. So it really seemed as if somehow there was some kind of intelligence there that knew when he was about to fire, and they disabled, something was disabling his equipment at the last minute. It wasn't that he was moving any closer. It was this very uncanny situation. So that, you know, that was what he experienced. He thought that something landed. He saw more things when he was flying down to the ground. I mean, it was an absolutely astonishing situation. And again, there were many other observers to this event besides him. So he went down, and there was an American official at the debriefing, and he, took down lots of notes and filed this report with the U.S. government. So it's really very exciting to read his story. And my job, you know, as the author of the book and the editor for all the chapters that were contributed by other people, was to really try to coax out of these writers as much emotion and personal involvement as I could. You know, military guys don't tend to reveal their feelings that easily. They don't want to tell you that they were afraid or how they felt at a given moment. So because I knew a lot of these men and they trusted me, you know, I would sort of help them try to draw out from them a more these kinds of emotions so that they would actually describe how they felt at a given moment when certain things were happening. And that was sort of, I feel good about the fact that I think they've all of them have communicated much more about their situations than anybody's probably ever heard before, because some of the cases are definitely familiar to people in the UFO field, but they're going to be getting more personal involvement, more personal information from the people involved who are writing these lengthy descriptions of what happened. So that makes it a lot more interesting.
Oh, of course it does.
Yeah.
Now, you also have a former governor of Arizona that made some statements for your book, too.
Absolutely. He's his story is so interesting because he had this complete kind of transformation from being this, well, he was governor of Arizona during the famous Phoenix Lights incident of 1997 when hundreds, if not thousands, of people in Arizona witnessed these giant, silent, boomerang-shaped craft sort of gliding over the state. And he was actually a witness to that himself that night. It was a one-time event, but it lasted a couple of hours, and never told anybody about it except his wife at the time he was the governor. And in fact, he even held a press conference, which is kind of notorious, a couple of months later, in which he made fun of the whole issue by dressing up his chief of staff like a Martian, and kind of marched him out in front of the cameras and said, I'm going to get to the bottom of this UFO thing, was what he told people ahead of time. I've got some information here. And then he marched out his chief of staff and made a joke of it. And people were very upset by that, people who had been involved and who were witnesses. So fast forward 10 years later, it's the 10th anniversary of the Phoenix Light, and there's a lot of commemorative events going on. And he decided, he was being interviewed by filmmaker James Fox, who was making a documentary, and he admitted on camera at that point that he actually had been a witness to this event. And he had never said that before to anybody publicly. And he said he believed that it was a craft of unknown origin. It was certainly not anything he had ever seen before, and he's a pilot as well as having been a governor. So that was a very important thing, and he's really come around and, you know, apologized to his constituents for his press conference and for upsetting people, and has really committed himself to working with this coalition that I'm involved with and trying to affect government policy. He believes that a government policy needs to change so that no other governor has to go through what he went through, and that, you know, obviously there should be a much more open policy about it. I mean, he was terrified to talk about this because he was so afraid of ridicule. So he's a very good spokesperson for this issue because he's actually had firsthand experience of being not only in political office but also a witness. And he knows how ineffective it is and how harmful it is that we don't have a better way of handling this within the government system. And he knows that from firsthand experience. So he's a real ally in the cause right now in trying to affect a change in policy. And it's just a very interesting story to read about his transformation and what he went through in coming from this one extreme to the other. So that's really the story of him. He writes a little piece in the book as well, and I also interviewed him and talk a lot about why he did what he did back then and what it means and, you know, why it's important, why he's such an example of why it's important that we change the situation. So,
Leslie, in some of your research, have you come up with any facts about the president's, you know, knowing and actually communicating with any extraterrestrials? Have you discovered any of that?
No, geez, I sure wish I could discover that, Nancy. That would be a scoop. But actually, no. I mean, I know there's a lot of information. You know, people say that, so Eisenhower had these communications or, you know, various stories are out there, and there's absolutely no documentation for, you know, there's no way that those stories can be verified. That's the point. And so as a journalist, I'm just not able to make use of that kind of information. Unless it's very, very solid and well backed up and corroborated, I'm really not interested in it because I have a certain role to play here, which is to prevent only that, you know, only that kind mm-hmm. of information to, and I'm trying to reach the mainstream. I'm trying to reach government officials, scientists, people that, you know, need to have this kind of absolutely, you know, corroborated information that you just can't argue with, basically. So if something isn't really well backed up, I just don't use it. And those are the kinds of stories that are intriguing but mm-hmm. aren't backed up. So I can't, and I haven't learned anything about them. I mean, I don't have any kind of inside scoop on any of the stories on the presidents beyond what's already out there. I wish I did, though.
Yeah, that would be kind of interesting because, yeah. You know, it would. I mean, I get emails from all different kinds of people who constantly are talking about UFOs and, you know, a lot of stories. And I've interviewed a lot of people who talk about Dulce, and they talk mm-hmm. about all the cover-ups going on with Roswell, Area 51, you know, and some of the other places. And it's very fascinating, but, you know, when you ask them, you know, can you prove it? I mean, is it right there in writing? Other than what you're saying, they kind of hesitate a little bit because they say, just like you do, unless it's totally, totally, you know, facts where I can prove the facts, it's very hard, you know, to get people to understand. But, right. You know, I've always been interested in UFOs. When I was a child, I saw some strange things, too. I didn't know what they were at the time, but, you know, everybody was reporting different things, you know, with different changing lights going on in the sky and stuff like that. And I thought, that's kind of cool. Where's that from? You know?
Yeah, so well, you're lucky. I've never seen one myself, so.
Well, you're going to have to come out here and visit me, Leslie, in New Mexico.
Yeah, I've been to New Mexico. The skies out there are pretty, pretty amazing and clear and wonderful, you know. But actually, you know, it's probably better. I mean, I've said this many times, and I think, you know, it's probably better in terms of the job I'm trying to do, Nancy, that I haven't seen one, because when I get asked that on kind of like mainstream radio stations and stuff, mm-hmm. you know, have you ever seen a UFO? If I said yes, I think it could be used as a way for people to think that, well, I've been affected by what I've seen. I'm just trying, you know, that somehow it keeps a certain sense of objectivity for me that I haven't
right.
seen one. I'm kind of an outsider looking in at the phenomenon, and I haven't been affected by having seen anything, and it just probably keeps it a little bit cleaner in terms of just the job I'm trying to do and the kinds of people I'm trying to reach. So I hope someday the one, you know, later on I'll get to see one, though.
Well, you come out here and see me.
Okay.
I'll show you the things that come up in the sky. We have two people call them stars, but they're not stars because they change colors. They go from blue to red to green to
mm-hmm.
yellow and white, and they're real, real high up there, and they're always an equal distance with each other. They never change
yeah.
that formation, but you can't see anything else other than those two, and I'm sure they're, you know, lots of miles away from each other, but from where I am looking out, and you can watch them, and it's really, again, kind of fascinating because, you know, stars don't change colors, and yet these things are out there changing colors, and it's like, okay.
Sounds a little bit like what General Jafari talked about, you know, this sort of,
mm-hmm.
the strobe light, kind of this large triangular kind of star-like thing that he described was changing colors. It had this sort of, you know, strobe effect of different colors, red, blue, orange, green. He even named the colors in the chapter.
Mm-hmm.
So who
yeah.
knows? He just might have, you know, the thing he saw might have just come in closer or something than the ones
mm-hmm.
that you've got out there. I have no idea, but it's all
yeah.
very fascinating.
It's kind of interesting out here. Believe me, there are just, like I said, a lot of things.
Yeah.
Now,
yeah.
Leslie, with this book here, the research that you did on it, which, you know, you did really well. I've not read your book yet, but I'm sure I'm going to get it eventually.
You are going to get it,
but,
yes.
Okay. But with the research on some of it, And I think you mentioned in your book, or somebody mentioned, the UAPs. Are UAPs different from UFOs?
Well, I mean, it's a good question. UAP, Unidentified Aerial Phenomena, is just an acronym that a lot of scientists prefer to use when they're talking about the phenomenon as opposed to UFO, just because of the baggage that the term UFO has. You know, that it's, you know, a lot of people think that UFO by definition means alien spacecraft, but it actually doesn't. It means unidentified flying object, and it was actually a term originally coined by the Air Force, U.S. Air Force, in the 50s, as meaning just something that's observed but can't be identified. And, you know, it's come to have this very loaded meaning for, and again, I'm talking about sort of status quo people that have an aversion to this. I'm not talking about you and me and lots of other people who are open about it, but people that are sort of affected by the kind of ridicule that's in the culture and so on. And the scientific community is trying to protect itself from people thinking that the research they're doing is sort of weird, you know, or it has to do with this sort of crazy subject of UFOs. So they prefer to adopt the term UAP. It also sort of has a broader definition than, I mean, it's basically the same thing, but it has a broader definition than unidentified flying object, and that it can include all kinds of aerial phenomena, you know, such as lightning and, you know, all kinds of phenomena that aren't necessarily flying objects. So it's broader, and it's that's the other reason they like it better, is that it can include more different possible explanations for whatever it is that they're studying. So some of the writers in my book have chosen to use that, and some of them haven't. It's, I just left it up to the person, but some people are much more comfortable with that, you know, just as a way of protecting themselves from being thought to be weird. So I'm glad you brought that up, because I think the term UAP is getting more and more usage, I think, now than it used to. I'm just seeing more people using it, and as more scientists get involved, I think we're going to see it more often. And So I use it sometimes, and depending on the circumstances that I'm in. But when I've written papers for officials or for, you know, documents that I want to be read by people in government or scientists, I will use that term, and I've been advised to do that, just because they can feel more comfortable with it. It's just sort of a way of, you know, making them feel more comfortable and therefore more willing to take it seriously. That's the reason I use it.
Yeah. I had a conference here this last April, and I actually brought in 16 guest speakers, and they were all different kinds, but they were talking about UFOs, like Colin Andrews was talking about crop circles, and one of the people that was one of the speakers was actually a retiree from NASA, and he said in his talk, he said, you know, that the NASA people have been covering up a lot of stuff about the moon because, you know, you only see really one side of the moon, and on the other side is a bunch of crashed, you know, objects, and they really don't want people knowing anything about it. You know, and he was pretty interesting, you know, and he said there's been many, many pictures that have come through that, of course, have all been, you know, classified so that you can't see them or anything. He said, but I was one of the people that helped, you know, sort out the pictures so we could see what was real and what's not. And what
Is his name Carl Wolf?
This one is Ken Johnston.
Ken Johnston. Okay, I don't know him.
Yeah.
But I met somebody else who talked about the same thing years ago. That's why I asked you. Yeah.
You know, and I'm sure there's probably a few more, but, you know, my question for that part, Leslie, is if there are these pictures and stuff, why again does our government in particular keep trying to hide the fact that these pictures are there and they're real and that they have them?
Right. Well, I mean, I don't know if the pictures are actually out there, are they? I mean, you know, people say they've seen the pictures, but we don't actually have the pictures to be displayed.
They're still...
And then again, it's the same problem we were talking about earlier about corroboration, you know, when you have a story of a guy who says, I saw these pictures, but that's not really going to carry it enough to open up the door because it's just one person's story. And you've got to be able to document what somebody says. He's got to get the pictures and somehow, or some kind of document that refers to them, or, you know, which is probably impossible.
I think,
but if you get two or three people saying the same thing, you know, unbeknownst to each other, that's a very good record, you know. And I maybe there's two people that have talked about the, you know, more than that even, that have talked about the NASA photos. So somebody would need to get all those people on the same page and kind of maybe, you know, write a story about what they're all saying and try to get mm-hmm. it out there. I mean, that's the kind of thing I could do with that kind of information. But unless we actually have the pictures, we're sort of stuck. That's the problem.
Yeah. Didn't one of the astronauts come forward finally and start talking about things that he had seen in his flights?
Yeah, I mean, I think different astronauts have said different things. And again, they are astronauts, so we have to take them seriously. But I think it's the same story where we don't have enough to back it up, you know, to actually be able to hit the government over the head and say, hey, here's proof, you know. But astronauts have talked about things that they've seen, without a doubt. But again, you know, it's not enough to really change the landscape of what we've got, of the sort of the resistance we have in government to looking at this.
Why do you think they stay so resistant, Leslie?
It's a really hard question to answer, Nancy, and I think it's really complicated. And, you know, I do go into this a lot in the book, but, you know, I don't really have an answer. I can tell you sort of my perception is that, you know, back in the 50s and 60s when we had the Air Force Project Blue Book, we actually had a government agency, a government project that was supposed to be investigating cases, and they did a very good job of debunking a lot of cases. Didn't do the greatest job as investigators, but nonetheless, at least we had this government agency that was looking into this. And during that time, we sort of developed a pattern of ridiculing cases. And a very interesting aspect of that, which I also write about in the book, is the 1953 Robertson Panel, which was a CIA organized meeting that lasted 3 days, in which the CIA brought together a bunch of hand-picked scientists, showed them some UFO data, and again, 3 days wasn't nearly enough time to really review everything that they had. But they were shown a bunch of stuff and then wrote this paper in which they recommended, actually, that all agencies of the government debunk UFOs. I mean, they actually used the word debunk, and it was presented as a suggested policy to other government agencies, and they have some kind of an education program in which they disabuse people of their notions of, you know, UFOs by using media and advertising and films and all these different ways in which they could minimize the importance of UFOs and debunk them. And so it sort of became part of the official approach to the subject way back in the 50s, and was carried on through the 60s. And then when Project Blue Book was closed and the Condon Report came out, which was this university report that basically said UFOs were not worthy of further study, which was a very important development in the whole history of this issue, that report sort of nailed the coffin down even tighter. The Blue Book was closed. And I think the attitude that had already been sort of put forward was just sort of maintained itself. It was like there was nothing to make it stop. And it's just decade after decade, this attitude of ridicule, of not wanting to have anything to do with this, has just perpetuated itself because nothing's been done to really overcome it within the government. And I also think, you know, it's what government would want to acknowledge the presence of something that they have absolutely no control over? I mean, I think if to whatever extent, we don't really know how much our government actually knows about this phenomenon and how much they don't know. But assuming they must know something, you can imagine that they would, you know, it's, and other government officials have told me this from other countries, it would make total sense that, you know, our government would not want to admit that there are objects in the sky that can come and go as freely as they want. They are extremely technologically advanced. We don't have any idea what they are, and we can do absolutely nothing about them. You know, that's not the kind of announcement they want to make to the public. So it's just easier for them to just turn their backs on this in terms of what they present publicly and just keep ignoring it, avoiding it, not dealing with it. And that's what they do. And, you know, it's very disturbing to people, especially people who've witnessed them themselves. But so I sort of see it as it really, the roots of it really take place decades ago. And it's just sort of this self-perpetuating system. And all of us out here, you know, I'm trying with my book to sort of bang on that wall and get them to take notice. And, you know, we're all trying in various ways to change that. But it's extremely difficult to change a sort of very deeply ingrained pattern, and I'm sure that has something to do with the fact that of what we're actually dealing with here. You know, it's a frightening thing, and not something that would be easy for a government to want to talk about, although I do make the point in the book, too, that other countries have approached this very differently than we have.
Mm-hmm.
And they are, you know, other countries have acknowledged, officially acknowledged, the existence of these phenomena, especially in specific cases that have happened, in which, you know, it's they're willing to hold press conferences about cases, about events that happen, and they're willing to say publicly, we can't explain what these things were, and it has not caused any kind of major panic or sociological breakdown in the society or anything that, you know, our government might expect could happen if such an announcement were made. That has not happened in these other countries in which these announcements have been made. But, you know, the United States of America is a very big and powerful country, so they may have more fear about doing something like that. Even just to acknowledge, Nancy, the simplest thing, which is such as a case that happened in 2006 at O'Hare Airport, in which a disc was mm-hmm. seen by people, just to be willing to say, we cannot explain what that was. Even
right.
that's a statement, that's all that's being asked of our government to do, and they will not even do that. And that is not hard for governments in other countries to do. They do it. They'll look at a case, they'll investigate it, hopefully, and they'll just say, you know, we couldn't explain that. But our government isn't willing to say that. So they are sort of a pariah in terms of the world situation, and you know, the closeness that exists here is pretty extreme, unfortunately. But, you know, instead of doing that, they will make up something and give an explanation if they're forced to, that
yeah,
that can be proven to be completely false, but nonetheless they just don't care. They'll toss it out there anyway and hope that it'll all go away, which is usually what happens. You know, people
mm-hmm.
they toss it out there, the press report it, the UFO people might point out that, in fact, it couldn't possibly be what they said it was. But then the thing kind of fades away, and nobody, that's the end of it.
Yeah.
So that's just the pattern we have. It's really frustrating.
Our government is good as, you know, letting things happen and then let it fade away so that everybody who was part of it seemed to think that they were crazy or wrong or probably totally out of their mind at the time. You know, our government's great for doing stuff like that.
It's really hard for those people. Yep, you're right.
Well, it is.
Hard
it's very
people.
Hard because, you know, there's a lot of people, you know, who I would think are probably doing a lot of suffering inside because, first of all, they don't want to come forward because if they come forward, they get to be interrogated and told that you're foolish and this could never happen, blah, blah, blah,
mm-hmm.
and it's best to keep quiet. Or they're thought of by the mainstream people as they got to be weird, crazy, or strange, or just want to make something to be on TV or radio, you know. And so I would think psychologically, a lot of these people who have experienced this are really, really having a hard time.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. Many of them are very, very, very affected by seeing something like this, especially if they're close up to it, and it changes mm-hmm. their whole perception of everything, you know. And yes, it can be psychologically even traumatizing for some of them. And to have their own government, you know, be willing to sort of like a slap in the face for them. And
yeah.
a lot of these people are government officials. They work for the FAA. They're patriotic people. And to not be taken seriously by their government when they are, you know, just simply reporting what they saw can be very devastating for them. You're absolutely right.
I talked to somebody who wrote a book called UFOs Exempt from Disclosure, The Black World of UFOs. It was pretty interesting, his book, and he had a lot of declassified information that dated all the way back to, you know, Eisenhower and Kennedy, and part of the reason why Kennedy was, you know, killed, and you know, it had some pretty good history stuff in there.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I can't, you know, prove any of it to be true, but he did have some declassified papers that kind of made sense with everything that we do know out there that our government just hopes will just go away, you know, and it was kind of interesting, too. Now, one of the other people that is in your book was Colonel Charles Holt.
Right, yeah. He actually wrote a chapter for the book himself about the famous Bentwaters case of 1980, which took place in England. And it's really one of the most, you asked me about, you know, which case did I think or which person did I think was the most interesting. Well, certainly this one is right up there. The Bentwaters case, one of the best, most well-documented events we have on record, I'd say, certainly in the top five, top ten, you know, cases ever. And two of the people involved with that case wrote chapters about it for the book. And Colonel Holt was actually deputy base commander on the night that there were a series of events, but on the night that he was involved with, it's a very complicated case, actually. But prior to the night that he went out, something had actually landed and had been witnessed by three people, and many others saw it taking off. But something had landed there, and he was called out after a day or two after that, and he actually went to the landing site and saw the imprints in the ground, radiation, and saw a lot of physical evidence at the landing site, and then started to witness this red light moving through the forest. It looked kind of like a blinking eye, and he was with a whole group of other people. They all saw this, and what's amazing is he had a pocket tape recorder with him. So as he was witnessing these things, he was talking into his tape recorder and recording what he was seeing and sort of the reactions that he was having, and it's a very fascinating thing. It's available for people to listen to. And anyway, he saw this red light, and then he saw these other objects in the sky that would broke up into other different, you know, smaller objects. And a little while later, there were beams of light that were being shot down literally feet from where he was standing, like pencil-thin beams shot right down to the ground. There were, you know, just a lot of the things that were going on at the Bentwaters Air Force Base in England back in 1980. So I think Colonel Holt is the highest level American military official ever to go on the record about a sighting, having been involved with an incident as well as having written a document about it. He wrote a very famous memo about what he experienced back then. He was required to do this, and that's he kind of downplayed it a bit in his memo, but it's still on the record that he actually wrote something about what happened. So it's a fascinating case. It's kind of too complicated to go into in a lot of detail here, but I wouldn't, you know, I think his chapter is very clear. And then the one by Jim Peniston, who was also there, who was actually touched a landed UFO a couple of days before Colonel Holt went out, which is phenomenal to read about. So that's a very, very important and exciting case.
And so have they still tried to debunk that, or are they working on it, you know, to try to prove that it's still right? I mean,
MOD did an investigation, and they documented, the Ministry of Defense in Britain documented that a lot of things about it, but one of them was that the radiation levels were way above normal at the site where the thing had landed. And so that's part of the government record, you know, and so nobody's ever been able to solve it. I mean, debunkers have tried to claim that it was a beam from a lighthouse, which is absurd, and because these people recognize what the lighthouse beam looked like since they were, you know, the beam was going around all the time. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't even have, you know, it's just, you know, they've come up with explanations like that, like they always do. These aren't government people, but these are the sort of standard debunking things that they'll say that are absolutely absurd. And but really, no one has ever been able to explain what happened there, and it just remains an unexplained case. But there are lots of government documents that support it and, you know, tell us more about it that are really important that have been released from the Ministry of Defense in the UK. So it's absolutely fascinating.
See, what's really fascinating, Leslie, is before, you know, you used to hear about all of the things that went on over by the UK. And people here would go, you know, that's kind of different. Why does it keep happening over there? But now all of a sudden it's happening all over the world. And, you know, whether you know a person, say, from China or a person from the UK, and it's a person here that have seen it, their stories are pretty much the same. You know, they describe almost the same stuff.
I think that's true. Yeah. It's a worldwide phenomenon.
Yeah, and yet we're still being told, no, this doesn't exist, this isn't true. You know, and like you said, they try to explain it away.
Right.
You know, and there's just some things that can't be explained, you know, that's going to make sense. You know,
right.
it just can't. See, I'm originally from the Chicagoland area,
mm-hmm.
so I know about the O'Hare incident.
good. Yeah.
You know,
well, that's also covered in the book, and that's a really important example of just the ludicrous approach that our government has. And it wasn't that long ago. It was only
mm-hmm.
2007 that the government made this ridiculous statement about that case. And let's not give it away. People have to read the book to find out what that was.
Yeah,
but,
no.
You know, and again, as you said, you know, government officials from other countries have, you know, as I mentioned, the the Bentwaters case, but thousands of documents have been released, thousands and thousands of documents from lots of different countries. You know, they've released their UFO files. France has done this, the UK has done this, and many other countries. And there's adequate documentation of a phenomenon that is unexplained, that is unknown, that exists. So, you know, and our government, too, has released very important documents. I mean, we have enough documents from our own government to prove the reality of a phenomenon. It's just that we don't, of course, know what it is. But our government really doesn't. You're right. I mean, they want to turn their back even on a phenomenon that has been already documented by their own government.
Mm-hmm.
They're not willing to say, yes, there is something here, and we don't know what it is. They just don't want to say that, even though their own documents show that. So there's something there that's keeping, you know, there's a fear. I mean, I think it's the fear of ridicule is very, very intense in this country, because I know that from having talked to people in Washington. I mean, there are many open-minded people in Washington that take this very seriously, but they are absolutely terrified of ridicule.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a real problem among the in the political world in Washington if anybody mentions this. Even if they mention it, you know, in a very low-key, professional way, there's just so much ridicule that gets dumped on them that it's really a liability, so they don't want to do it. And the other issue, of course, is just whatever, you know, fear there might be among officials who maybe know something more about this, and just what we were talking about earlier about whether the government would really want to acknowledge something for fear of whatever, thinking that they don't have control over it. They don't like. No government wants to acknowledge things flying around in their airspace that they can't control. Let's put it. That's it in a nutshell.
Right, but see, the truth is that a lot of the American people, you know, they have done some of their own investigations, and you know, they come up with some pretty good evidence. And yet, again, they're basically told that they're nuts or crazy or whatever. To me, it would just make more sense, Leslie, if our government just said, yes, there is this thing, we don't know what it is, but, you know, we're looking into it. I mean, how hard is that?
I agree with you.
It just makes no sense, you know. Instead, they keep lying to the public and lying to the public, and at some point in time, after so many lies, who is really going to trust the government? They're going to go, oh, they're lying about this too, or they're lying about that, blah, 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 you know. And it makes no sense. They should just really come clean, and whether it's, you know, and admit that it's out of fear, we can't control it or whatever, but we're still looking into it, you know, and then work with all the rest of the you know, countries around the world who are also having the same kind of thing, and have one good team that's not afraid to report truth and what they've found. I mean, that would just make a whole bunch more sense rather than, oh, no, no, there's not this, it's not that, it's a weather balloon, it's, you know, just something in the sky that's, you know, just a jet flying over. You know, I mean, they come up with some of the most lame excuses, you know, and it's
right,
like...
Right. Well, I completely concur. I mean, what you're saying is extremely rational. It makes total sense, and you're right. It's irrational, so it's very frustrating for us who know something about this to stand back and watch this irrational behavior. I mean, I can hear it in your voice. I know exactly. Completely agree with you. Of course, it would make a lot of sense. You keep saying it would make sense. It would, but they're not doing it, and that's why, you know. And I actually, in my book, I'm really working towards what you said at the end of what you just eloquently described about having a team that would work with governments in other countries. I mean, that's exactly right. And I've proposed a plan in my book for that to actually happen. I'm really trying to affect policy. It's very difficult, but I am working with people in positions of authority to try to change policy so that we can get some kind of government team, or even just one person who can be officially responsible for working with the officials from other countries who have been involved with this for a long time and have, you know, so we can become a team player. And
yeah, I mean,
I really hope that can happen. I'm trying to make that happen, but there's a lot of, it's just very, very difficult. There's so much resistance, and the ridicule factor is just so huge here that it's really difficult to get them to come around, but we just have to keep working on it, and I'm very committed to doing that. But I think you're absolutely right. That's what we need.
What we really do. It would make more sense if you know, our government in particular, because a lot of the other governments have already acknowledged it. But if our government would just say, hey, we're going to join, you know, forces with blah, 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 you know, to find out what this is it truly a threat to us, you know, our world, or is it, you know, just other, you know, beings coming in to see who we are, what we have, what we don't have, maybe going to, you know, give us some more information, you know, more intelligent information. I mean, it would just make more sense for that to be announced rather than them keep going, no, 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 this is, it's not what you think, it's not what you see. Now, you also had somebody in your book called John Podesta, P-O-D-E-S-T-A.
Podesta, yeah.
Now, who's he and what did he have to say?
Are you talking about John Podesta who wrote the foreword, right?
Yes.
I think that's who you mean. I know you don't have the book in front of you, and that's not your fault. It's my publisher's fault, just so people know that. But John Podesta was actually the former chief of staff under President Clinton. And he also was the co-chair or the chair, I'm not sure which, of President Obama's transition team. So he was responsible for actually pulling together various cabinet members. And he's very influential within the Democratic Party and within the Obama administration, as well as having served under Clinton. He started a group in Washington called the Center for American Progress. It was a progressive think tank that's very well thought of in Washington and writes a lot of policy papers and is influential. And I have a long history of sort of having his support because I was involved back beginning in 2000 with a Freedom of Information Act effort to acquire documents on a case called the Kecksburg UFO. It was a case of a crashed object in Pennsylvania back in 1965. And John Podesta is very much an advocate for open government. And when he was serving under Clinton, he played a large role in reforms that were made in the Freedom of Information Act. And is very much, you know, believes that all information, government information, should be given to the public as much as possible. And in that context, he supported our effort and publicly spoke out on behalf of this Freedom of Information Act effort that I was sort of spearheading. And he's interested in the UFO subject. He's curious about it. And he was willing to stand up at our press conferences and be supportive of this effort. And so I sort of got to know him a little bit during that time. And he's always respected the way I approach the subject, because I'm very careful to approach it in a way that, you know, appeals to somebody like him, a person in government. And so, anyway, when we came around to publishing this book, he agreed to write the foreword for it, and I'm extremely honored that he was willing to do that, and I think it's really helped the book a lot to sort of allowed government people who might not otherwise read it, when they see that John Podesta has written the foreword for it, there are many, he has a lot of friends in Washington, so those people will take a look at it just because of his role in this. Mm-hmm. So it's really been a big boost for the book that he's done that, and he's been a very important insider who's been willing to be helpful in the process of trying to create change in Washington. And even with people like that, it's still very difficult, even having someone like him helping out. Mm-hmm. But nonetheless, he's been an extremely important influence on me and on, you know, an extremely important voice as somebody who supports the work I'm doing, and I'm very honored by that. So I think his foreword is extremely eloquent, and, you know, it's a great way to open up a book on the subject matter is to have someone of his stature write something about it. I'm very happy about his foreword to the book, and I think people will find it interesting when they read it.
Well, no, I'm looking forward to getting the book, actually, so I can read it.
Definitely. We'll make sure that happens.
Since you have written the book and it's been out there, Leslie, have other people come to you and want to talk to you about some of their experiences now?
Yeah, they have. I mean, people have written to me about, and, you know, people that just have had simple sightings have written to me. And also what's really interesting to me, though, is the numbers of scientists that have actually written to me. I've just been so pleased by that. And there were a lot of scientists who endorsed my book. I mean, you don't have it in front of you, but there are blurbs by, you know, very respectable PhDs that support this book, one of them being Michio Kaku, who's a very well-known physicist. And so, you know, because of the way it's written and the way it handles the information, it sort of allows the scientists to access the information in a way that they've never been able to before. And some of them have written me and just said, you know, I've been completely transformed by your book. I've never been able to take this seriously before. I've never been able to believe in it before, you know, and your book has completely changed my attitude towards the subject. And, so that's really satisfying to me when I get letters like that from people in the scientific community. That's happened. I've been saving those articles. And, you know, a lot of them have come around. And for the paperback edition, we had Derek Pitts, who wrote an endorsement for it. He's a very well-known astronomer, actually, with the Franklin Research Institute in Philadelphia, who's a public person. He used to go on TV with on MSNBC quite a bit. And he's, you know, kind of a well-known voice in the scientific television world. And he actually used to debunk UFOs on TV. And after reading my book, and I had a chance to meet with him, he invited me to the museum, actually, to speak at his institute. He has completely changed his attitude now towards the subject. And it was just like a complete change for him, from thinking nothing of this to completely getting it and asking, you know, why don't more scientists take this seriously? I mean, that's what he kept asking me. My God, you know, this is so fascinating. Why don't more of scientists research it and take it seriously? And that's the question that's in his mind. So it does have a transformative effect on people. And again, I'm just trying to provide the kind of information that can reach people like that, you know, people that have never seen a UFO and that have always thought it was something that they should not take seriously. It's very hard to read this book and come away and feel that you can't take it seriously, because it just provides the kind of information that is going to force you to realize that there's something going on. You can't come away from this and believe there's nothing to it. Unless you want to make the assumption that every single person in the book is lying and all the government documents are false. You can do that if you want. But anyway, it's very convincing for that kind of a person. So I've been very gratified by all the scientists that have written me, especially.
That's good. In your book, for the contributors that you have in the book, most of them really aren't from the United States, are they?
Unfortunately not, but you're absolutely right. And I was actually glad to have in some ways it's unfortunate, because I wish there were more higher-level people from the United States, but I'm also very glad to have representatives from around the world. I think it's something like 9 different countries that are represented in this book by people who have written chapters from these other countries. So I think it's actually wonderful to have a kind of an international perspective on this. And, you know, I have a general from Belgium that wrote about the incredible wave of sightings that took place there in 89 and 90. It's so much better to read it in their own words than it is to just have me tell you what they said. So, but we do have quite a few Americans also. We've got people from the UK, Iran, and from Peru, but we also have a former NASA senior scientist who's written a piece. And we have the former governor that we talked about earlier. We have a former very high-level FAA official who's written a piece as well. And so, you notice the former. It helps a lot that they're retired. I think if they were, you know, most of the people in America who are willing to talk about this, people of any stature, are going to be retired people. Same with Colonel Charles Holt, who we talked about earlier.
Mm-hmm.
In other countries, you know, some people have written for this book who are actually still active, who are not just, they're not just retired people. And for instance, in the country of Chile, that country actually has its own government agency that does nothing but studies UFOs. I mean, it's a dedicated government agency to look at this issue. And the person who is in charge of that agency now has written a chapter. So he's not somebody who's just was doing it years ago. He's somebody actively involved. We have 2 people from Chile who are actively involved in this, who work for the government, who have written chapters. So that's an example of, you know, South America is much more open and more active on this issue than North America. And there's a number of countries that have government agencies that are involved, and Chile is one of them, and we're fortunate enough to have 2 men from that country write some fascinating accounts in this book, and also a general from Peru has written a very fascinating chapter as well. So, yeah, it's a very internationally oriented book, and I wish we had a general from America, but we don't. We have a colonel from America, but so far no generals are willing to go on the record.
Well, maybe, Leslie, as more sightings start to happen, and they will,
because it's like coming no matter what people seem to think. Maybe at that point in time there will be a general that comes forward, or maybe even the rest of our government will finally have to admit that, yeah, they're here and we are looking into it, you know, stuff like that. That is coming, because I just cannot believe that a country like ours that's supposed to be so much up on everything can sit in a state of denial for one as long as we have, or could do it indefinitely like they're trying to do. So, you know, it's going to come.
I think you're right. It's just a matter of time. And maybe the phenomenon itself will force it to happen by just if we have some kind of spectacular sighting, you know, again, in which thousands of people witness something. You know, now more and more people have cameras with them. They have their iPhones or their, you know, cell phones, and they have video cameras. And I think that if there was some, and the media is really very interested in this topic now, so I think if there was some mass sighting again, such as the one that happened in Phoenix, I think we'd get a lot, even more documentation on it than we got then. And it would, you know, eventually something like that is just going to be impossible for the government to ignore it. I mean, they completely ignored the incident in Phoenix. You know, there was no explanation provided by any government official about what happened. And, you know, Senator McCain wrote to the Air Force to try to get information. There was a lawsuit filed against the Department of Defense, a class action lawsuit by a group of witnesses that went to court. And, you know, the Department of Defense was ordered to do a search for, you know, what was this gigantic thing over Phoenix? Do they have any files related to it? They came back and said, we have nothing. So they were just sort of ignored it, as if, and here was this thing flying over a major city in America, you know, this low-flying, gigantic craft, low to the ground, and our government ignores that? I mean, what if it was something dangerous, you know? It's just sort of inconceivable now, I think also after 9/11 and the events of that. It's inconceivable to me now that if something like that happened again, it could just be ignored. You know what I mean? I think that something like that could force a response unlike any we've ever had before, just because of our technology is so much different now, and our media is more onto it, and, you know, there would just be more of an outcry, I think. So maybe something like that will happen again.
I'm pretty sure it's due. Anyway, our time is almost up, Leslie, and I really hate to let you go, but before you do, please give out the name of your book again, how the people can get it, and your website, and then talk a little bit about your blog.
Okay, sure. Well, the name of the book is UFOs, Generals, Pilots, and Government Officials Go on the Record, and my last name is spelled K-E-A-N, for those who might not know, and you can get the book by going to my website, which is UFOsOnTheRecord.com. You can click on the link there to Amazon or Barnes & Noble. All the major booksellers carry the book. It is out in paperback, so it's not as expensive as it was in hardback. It's got glossy photographs in it, and it's a very attractive book, I think you will find. And my blog, I mean, the main blogging I do is really on my Facebook page. I have a very active Facebook page. I'm very responsive to people on that page. And I would encourage people who are interested to talk more about any of this to please visit me there. It's just an open page on Facebook. You just search my name, and it's my author page. I do have a blog on my website, but I really haven't been keeping it up. So the best place to communicate is really on the Facebook page. Or certainly visit the website. There's lots of information on the website. But in terms of actually communicating, there is a form, you know, you can communicate by sending me a message through the site, or you can go onto Facebook and chat with people there, and I will respond to anybody that goes onto Facebook. So, and I thank you, Nancy, so much for having me on and giving me the opportunity to talk and to tell people about the book, and I really appreciate all your very thoughtful questions.
Great. It was very good having you on, and like I said, we'll talk again. Don't worry.
Okay.
All right, and thank you for taking the time, Leslie. It's been my pleasure, too.
It's been my pleasure. Thanks a lot.
You're very welcome. I'd like to thank you, the listeners. May God bless all of you. Have a great week, and we'll talk to you whenever. Have some nice holidays. They are yet to come, so take care. Bye now.